Welcome to Countries That Don't Exist Anymore, the historical entertainment show about countries lost to the myths of history, the myths of mystery, and the hips of misbury.
Countries that don't exist anymore, they used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for, it's countries that don't exist anymore.
This week we take a belated trip to the African continent to visit the country once known as the Aksumite Empire, the Kingdom of Aksum, or just Aksum. It's every 90s skater dude's favourite first millennium African powerhouse, Aksum!
Why was it called the Aksumite Empire? The Kingdom of Aksum, or Aksum.
Ask someone else about it.
Ed?
Oh. Let's take a look at the actual name. Some people think the etymological root of the word Aksum comes from a mixture of two languages, Semitic and Cushite. The Semitic languages are the ones found in the Middle East, Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa.
But what's this Kushite? Is it a quilted toilet paper?
Like most empires, Aksum took over from another regional power. In this case, the Kingdom of Kush, a mighty kingdom in Sudan, which in turn was another civilization that prospered from the breakup of the new Kingdom of Egypt. It's like empire dominoes. The point is that this part of Africa was well used to organised civilizations long before a bunch of syphilitic 19th century Europeans got their damn dirty paws on it. But sticking with the name, there's another theory. The name Aksum might also come from the local Kunama language, which long predated Aksum. In that language, Aksum is derived from two words, meaning hill and climb. I guess this makes sense, as the roads to Aksum are notoriously hilly. So, which do you think is more likely, Phil?
What?
The Semitic Kushite amalgamation or the Kunamic topographical description?
The last one. The last one he said.
Interesting choice. I mean, each theory has its supporters, right?
Yeah, certainly do.
I guess it depends if you're a disciple of the founder of cultural geography, Carlo Sawyer, or a proponent of Guiderboard's theories around psychogeography.
Yep, probably does, yep.
Wow, that's amazing, Phil. You've really come a long way. You seem really engaged and knowledgeable now.
Yeah, cheers.
While most cities are located near rivers or coasts or on nice flat ground, Aksum is located at an altitude of 2,100 metres. So the idea that the city is possibly named after the journey there makes sense. Aksum, hill climb. In the same way, London is an old English word meaning from the Great River, or M25 tailback. No one can agree. But back to Aksum. Defences aside, building a city up high makes sense in Ethiopia, since the altitude gives the city a balmy annual temperature of 20 degrees Celsius and leaves the surrounding area blissfully mosquito-free.
Yeah, so the founders of Aksum didn't get that gross feeling of accidentally swallowing insects when cycling in summer.
Yeah, or dying of malaria.
Yeah, also important, yeah.
It was also a plum spot for trade, as Aksum linked roads to the Nile Valley, Sassu, the seaport of Adulis, Shua, and the Afar Lowlands, none of which I know a ton about.
How large was Aksum?
1.25 million kilometres squared, or 480,000 square miles, which is about twice the size of France. Double France!
Double France, makes your breath smell garlicky. Double France!
What language was spoken in Aksum?
Ge'ez, a Semitic language once spoken commonly, but now only surviving as the official language of the Ethiopian church. These days, Ethiopians speak Amharic, which is like the descendant of Ge'ez. So Ge'ez is no longer spoken in the way that in the Roman Empire, it was once Latin, but now everyone speaks Italian.
Ge'ez, of course. So probably related to Cockneys.
What?
You know, Ge'ez. Geezer.
Ooh, geezer! Many link, my son! I'll be seeing you later!
What?
How long did Aksum last?
The empire lasted from 100 AD to 940 AD. So, about 840 years. Now, that's pretty impressive. When you think that, according to an article by David Stuckey on Vice.com, The average country's life expectancy is 158 years, and it would probably be a lot higher if it weren't for that pesky interfering Fourth Roman Republic and its minute lifespan.
Available in Series 1 of Countries That Don't Exist Anymore, now!
So, Aksum was a serious player and major urban centre. In fact, the term metropolis was coined in the 1st century in a work called Periphas of the FC to describe the city of Aksum.
Not so spicy, meter factable!
Aksum was world famous too. The Persian prophet Mani, who lived in the 3rd century AD, reckoned Aksum to be one of the big four powers of the time, along with Rome, Persia and China. And while I'm tooting Aksum's trumpet, we can find references to the state in Dante's Divine Comedy, the Quran, the Iliad and the Bible.
Which part of the Bible?
If you open your Bible to 1 Kings...
No, you're right. What kind of government did Aksum have?
Well, most definitely a monarchy. What seems to happen in the formation of Aksum was that many chiefs fought against each other and competed until someone came up on top and became king. And that system kept on going as Aksum expanded outwards. To support this idea, archaeologists have revealed the existence of many smaller polities called petty kingdoms.
How is your kingdom, Your Majesty?
Considerably larger than yours, Your Majesty.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't. Where was the Aksumite Empire located?
Spread across parts of Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, and at its height in western Yemen on the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. The empire had its capital in Aksum in northern Ethiopia. The city of Aksum was founded in the 4th century BC, but rose to prominence in the 1st century AD, which gives it a similar trajectory and lifespan to the Roman Empire. Aksum!
In Africa, founded by Africans, Piffle and Codswallop must have been founded by ancient Greeks, Babylonians, or other, you know, not black people.
Nope, it was founded by Africans. So eat that accurate reflection of 1960s imperialist British historian stereotype. Aksum gained its vast wealth by being a major player in the trade routes between the Romans, ancient India and China. The growing trade of the Roman Empire led directly to a steadily more powerful Aksum, who got rich off that trade.
We have priceless spices, rich silks, precious pigments and glowing gold. What have you to trade in return?
We have shiny helmets with lots of feathers in them.
Cool! Merch!
To facilitate the lucrative trade, Aksum produced gold, silver and copper coins and was one of the earliest states in Africa to do so. From 270 AD, golden Aksumite coins were minted by King Endibus. The coins were vital for the booming trade, but also promoted the wealth and power of Aksum and its state religion.
And what was the state religion?
At the beginning of its existence, Aksum had a polytheistic religion, but later converted to Christianity under King Etzana, apparently under the influence of Byzantine missionary Frumentius of Tyre. This happened shortly after Constantine's conversion in the Roman Empire, but Etzana was one of the first to mint gold coins with a cross on them. But the Kingdom of Aksum also has a long Jewish tradition.
Aha! Ah, you see! It was founded by Israelites. Good old pale-faced white Israelites.
No, this area of Africa has a separate Jewish tradition.
Oh, bugger.
The stories go that this was supposedly bought from the court of King Solomon by the Queen of Sheba. She apparently travelled from Aksum to Judah to visit King Solomon, liked what she saw, and brought back the Jewish tradition lock, stock and barrel. But is there any evidence for this? Well, there's the ruins of a grand castle at Dungur in Ethiopia that locals will tell you was the palace of the Queen of Sheba. It's said you can still feel her presence in the corridors.
Wow, so it was actually owned by the Queen of Sheba?
Well, it's dated to 300 years after she was supposed to be around, so unless she lived to the age of 300...
Wow, she lived to the age of 300? It's incredible.
Do you think that's likely, Phil?
Well, if you look in the Bible, people lived really old. Moses, 900 years, the others really long. So, it's there, it's in the book.
Okay, fair point. Whatever the truth of the story, Ethiopia for a long time had a thriving Jewish community known as Beta Israel. Presumably it used to hang out with Alpha Israel, but never got the girls. So, assuming the Queen of Sheba story is so much nonsense, we're not exactly sure how the community ended up there. But given the long-term trade links between Ethiopia and the Levantine, it's not so surprising. On the other hand, the Queen of Sheba story has a clearer narrative, so, you know, choose your own adventure. The castle at Dunga is still worth talking about, though, as it's about the earliest example of Aksumite architecture around. The palace complex contains a kitchen with large brick oven, rooms with bathing facilities, and a home cinema with Dolby surround sound. Okay, not that last one. But this lavish palace demonstrates that Aksum was a thriving civilization, and there are others. The typical palatial design was a square, flat-roofed building, generally made of clay, with squared towers. They look a bit like sandcastles, but much more impressive and unlikely to be kicked over by an irritable child denied ice cream. The top tier of Aksumite society was truly wealthy. Archaeological records show that they could afford to import pottery from as far afield as Persia and Central Asia. Aksum also claimed to be a religious centre, partly because it claims ownership of the Ark of the Covenant. You know, the fancy box supposedly containing the Ten Commandments.
Well, actually, Ed, I think you'll find that the CIA have the Ark of the Covenant in underground storage. Yep, I actually saw it in this documentary recently.
Did this documentary involve lots of Nazis having their faces melted?
Yeah, have you seen it?
Yeah, it was a great documentary. So, back to the Queen of Sheba visit Solomon's story. Their son was said to be King Menelik, who was a real king, who is also said to be the first ruler of the Kingdom of Aksum. And he's the one who's supposed to have brought back the Ark of the Covenant, which remains in Ethiopia to this day and is guarded in a small church. And in case you're wondering, no one's allowed to look at it. But some bishops say it's definitely real. So why would a bishop lie? Of all people. Partly because of the supposed presence of the Ark, Aksum saw itself as a centre for Christianity, as Ethiopia does to this day. Incidentally, if you ever visit, you can still see the exterior of the church where the Ten Commandments are supposed to be kept. You'll still find it guarded by a single lone monk who isn't allowed out of the church.
Excuse me, I'm quite bored. Does anybody fancy a game of Scrabble? Hello?
And because some of Aksum's exports included the famous biblical gifts of gold, frankincense and myrrh, it's safe to say that Aksum's twin pillars were trade and religion. Things that shouldn't really go together but are often synonymous. So for example, merchants spread religion, religion sends their own salesman to close the deal.
I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven, and yes, I'm white.
But isn't the eye of the needle a desert valley that camels regularly pass through?
Exactly. What I'm saying is, it's easy. Now leave all of your possessions and follow me.
Yeah, sorry Jesus, but I think I actually want to keep my possessions.
Okay, either is fine.
Aksumite churches, of which there are many, are built on hilltops. This may be because hilltops are safer because you can see for miles around, or because they're quiet and good for prayer, or because being on top of a hill means that you're literally closer to God.
Our Father, which art in heaven, actually pretty close to us up there, hallowed be thy name.
Hey you mortals, keep it down! Don't you know this is my day of rest?
What happened to dead Aksumites?
As you might have guessed by now, we don't have a huge amount of written records about Aksum. One good way of discovering more about people is what happened to them when they died. With the Anglo-Saxons, it could be ship burials. With the Egyptians, pyramids. But with the Aksumites, it was both large underground tombs and tall obelisks called stelae. Venture into the tomb of King Caleb, for example, and you'll find a labyrinth of subterranean tunnels and chambers held up with massive megalithic stones seamlessly joined together Inca style. Within separate smaller rooms, King Caleb and high officials were laid to rest in solid stone sarcophaguses.
Oh, sounds fancy. But what happened to ordinary Aksumites when they died?
I don't know. Flushed down the toilet, probably. The other monument to death above the tombs were stelae. These are like tall obelisks, like Cleopatra's Needles or the Washington Monument. The Aksumite versions were carved to look like houses, literally houses of the dead. And some of these stelae are huge, like mini skyscrapers, literally mini skyscrapers of the dead, or dyscrapers, if you will. The largest we know of is the obelisk of Aksum, which is 24.6 metres tall, which was stolen by the Italians in 1936. Boom! But returned since.
Yay!
Stelae were carved in situ in quarries and then transported by elephants. We know this because there are still some which have only been partially carved out of the rock, and lots of elephants still have bad backs. Stelae actually date back to around 5000 BC, but survive through the Christian conversion. That's because they're obviously much better than piddly little headstones.
Who were the Axumites?
While the origins of people are usually a combination of history plus myth, and we're only just uncovering a lot of this history, the people of Saba crossed the 25-kilometer strait between the Arabian Peninsula and the African continent. They bought irrigation techniques which boosted crop yields and gave Axum the edge. This probably happened over a long period of time, rather than, say, one afternoon in July. But more recent work has suggested that while the Sabaeans did extend control to parts of Axum, the occupation was short-lived and their influence has been exaggerated in the retelling. Certainly we know that the local Agor people started expanding the city of Axum from 400 BC.
So we don't really know yet.
Exactly. Serious archaeological work on Axum is still in the works, but keep digging.
What? You mean to tell me none of these are facts?
I mean, they are facts. It's just that, you know, we haven't quite...
Well, what have I been asking questions for all this time? This is ridiculous.
It was mentioned as a trading hub in a 1st century BC in a trader's handbook called the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. Is he gone? Thank God. Okay, where was I? Oh yes, it was mentioned in a trader's handbook called the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. That's not easy to say. The kingdom was very fertile and seemingly completely self-sufficient for foodstuffs as it exported large quantities of agricultural produce. This would help it survive later in its history when it was cut off from its trading partners. Although it was a trading power, Axum was established far inland. It was rich with resources both in terms of flora, fauna and minerals, but also it boasted rich, fertile farmlands of the western and eastern lowlands and the northern and central highlands. Evidence suggests that in the 1st century AD there was extremely heavy rainfall in the area, setting up the Axumite breadbasket for its rise to self-sufficient glory.
It's raining again.
I noticed.
Oh, it's been going on for 100 years now. I wish it'd stop.
It'll set us up nicely for agricultural fecundity and great power status in the ancient world, though.
True. Mustn't grumble.
Axum also had the necessary resources to build the kind of grand structures associated with ancient powerhouses. It had limestone for statues, sandstone for stelae, gemstones for ornaments, and black marble for kitchen work surfaces.
What kind of things did Axum trade? Ed, I think we should get the other guy back.
Okay, let him in.
Alright, just...
Do you want to come back in?
Are you going to give me the facts?
Yeah, we will.
Okay. Right. What kind of things did Axum trade? And answer it this time.
Mainly gold, iron and salt.
Acceptable.
It commanded the ivory trade coming out of Sudan and also ferried slaves, tortoise shells, spices, silks, emeralds and crafted goods between Rome and India. Many of the exotic beasts slaughtered in the Roman Colosseum would have come from Axum. A lot of the rhino horn the Chinese stirred into their Rice Krispies also came from Axum.
Salt, ivory, exotic beasts, slaves... Rhino horn, these people sound like bastards.
Rest assured that these were ethically produced, free-range, sustainable slaves.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
One of the major power centres before the rise of Axum was Adulis, a once major port city which is now 7 kilometres inland, which can be quite the setback for the economy of a major port city. Archaeological work around Adulis has revealed a grand city which included a 9th century BC Sphinx and an opulent palace. Along with another trading city called Caheto, the Axumites are thought to be a blend of Sabaeans and the people of Adulis. The link with Saba would also make sense because between 183 to 213 AD, the Axumites crossed the Red Sea and conquered Saba, which you could either see as a homecoming, or perhaps they only decided they were from there anyway to justify the action. Who knows?
Well, historians, probably. I'm sure all the answers are online with a little bit of research.
No, they're not. Huh. A lot of our scant knowledge comes from a 4th century king called Azana. He was the guy who minted the coins and introduced Christianity. He took the title Nagusa Nagast, or King of Kings.
I am King of Kings.
Oh yeah? Well, I am King of King of Kings.
Yeah, well, in that case, I am King of King of King of Kings.
Oh, that's nothing, for I am King of King of King of King of Kings.
Oh yeah? Well, take this, because I am King of King of King of King of King of Kings.
No, I am King of King of King of King of King of King of King.
No, I am King of King of King of King of King of King of King.
Ha ha! King of King of King of King of King of King of King.
No, I am King of King of King of King of King of King of King.
I am King of King of King of King.
I am King of King of Kings.
I'm King 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 King.
Hi listeners, to hear the full sketch, don't forget to subscribe to our Patreon.
Under Izana, Axum pushed into the crumbling kingdom of Kush and took Mero, which was like its capital city. Azana's throne name was Ella Ebraha, a Christian name. One of his titles was Son of the Invincible Marem. Marem was one of the names of the pagan gods of the Semitic people, the equivalent to Roman god of war Mars.
But they converted to Christianity, so Marem was pretty vincible after all. You know, for a skinny bearded guy, Christ certainly defeated a lot of other gods.
Izana was influenced by the Christianity of the Eastern Roman Empire. His tutor was a Christian slave from the Mediterranean who'd worked his way up to be an influential 4th century bishop and later saint, Archbishop Frumentius of Abyssinia.
What an inspirational tale. So if you get sold into slavery, work hard and never give up. You too could move to Ethiopia, wear golden dresses and cover up widespread institutional abuse.
It's a story that touches all of our hearts.
Ah, oh, it's the dream, isn't it?
The Eastern Roman or Byzantine Empire and Axum were allies and trading partners. In the mid-6th century, Axumite King Caleb caught the attention of famed Byzantine Emperor Justinian I, who sent an ambassador named Julian to sort out a pact between the two great empires. Their common enemy was the Sassanid Empire to the east, who had adopted Zoroastrianism.
Oh!
Exactly. Julian described how Caleb approached on a golden chariot drawn by 4 elephants. Caleb wore a cloak and garments of golden cloth with a shirt made of embroidered pearls. Dry clean only. The links between Axum and the Eastern Romans were strong, especially through religion. The Axumite church were influenced by Byzantine Monophysites.
Oh, Byzantine Monophysites. Yeah, I was reading about those. They're pretty important, you know, in the past.
In our time, get this guy on.
Yeah.
God, Phil.
Oh, you're welcome.
Who were the Monophysite priests?
So, Monophysite priests were booted out of Byzantium when they fell out of favour. But who were they? Well, they taught that Christ had only one divine nature, which contradicted the teachings of the church agreed at the 4th century ecumenical council of 451 AD, the Council of Chalcedon. I'm not going to go into why this was such a huge deal, because at the time, minor theological differences were absolutely huge, like what was the nature of Christ and which side of his head did he part his hair on. These were a matter of life and death.
It was the left!
It was the right!
Friends, please, let us compromise and say it was in the centre.
That's a blasphemous fringe belief!
Heretic!
Anyway, the point is that this gave Axum its very own distinctive Christianity that survives to this day. We can see the Ethiopian tradition as having equal footing to Greek Orthodoxy or Roman Catholicism. Axum depictions of Christ and the saints that adorns its churches and shrines is very distinctive, complete with gold leaf and bright, boisterous colours. It's like Byzantine meets the Teletubbies, and I do mean that as a clumsy compliment. Look up some of it online to see what I mean, or in fact, just go to our website, I'll post some pictures up there. It's African Christianity in its most ancient form. The images are distinctly African. Christ, Mary and the saints are black.
But that's ridiculous. They lived in Palestine. They'd obviously have pallid white skin with fair hair and blue eyes.
I know, right?
Huh.
Oh, and while you're at it, check out the churches of Lalibela carved into rock. They actually came after Axum had fallen, but as an expression of Ethiopian Christianity, they're pretty incredible.
When was Axum at its most powerful?
Axum probably reached its height under King Caleb, who invaded Yemen on the Arabian Peninsula in 520 AD. Now, Axum already had huge influence over the Arabian area of Najran, building church and converting the populace. But this didn't please the Himyarites, a Jewish kingdom in Arabia. Yes, such a thing existed. Himyarite king Dunuas didn't take too kindly to all this God having a son stuff and invaded Najran, determined to cleanse the area of heretical Christianity. His armies attacked and massacred Christians of the area, burned churches, and did the kind of things that armies go about doing. The Byzantines weren't having any of this, so they asked the Axumites to intervene. Fortunately, King Caleb, the great-great-great-grandson of Izana, was an especially pious Christian who definitely was not having any of this either. He sent an army who crossed into Arabia. Dunuas apparently responded by getting into the sea, literally. Some sources say that he rode a horse into the sea. Others say that he straight jumped in there. One thing was for sure, when it came to defensive strategies, Dunuas was out of his depth. Najran was officially made a viceroy of Axum, and everything was chill. Until a few years later, the garrison mutinied and declared that their general, Abraha, was king of Yemen. Caleb was still of the not having any of this outlook and sent armies to sort it out. But Abraha proved a more capable foe than his predecessor by not jumping into any sea at all and actually defeating the armies of Axum. Meanwhile, Caleb abdicated and retired to a monastery, so jumping into an altogether different kind of sea. It's a joke about, you know, church lands, the sea of... Okay. Abraha's successor, his son Masruq Abraha, went back to paying tribute to Axum, but Masruq's half-brother, Mad Karib, revolted. He was always going to. He was Mad Karib. He managed to enlist the help of the Sassanid Persians, who went stomping around the Axumite territories. Now, the Axumite-Persian wars rumbled on for a bit, but the upshot was that by 570, Axum had lost control of the peninsula. At about this time, Axum stopped producing gold coins, so it would never be so large and so powerful again.
Why did Axum go into decline?
A further problem for Axum seems to be internal divisions between Christians and Jews. At some point, the Axumite Jews decided to move north and establish their own kingdom of Beta Israel. In a period of war and unrest, the anarchy allowed pirates to start spreading off the coast of Eritrea, and then, in 714, these pirates attacked Jeddah, an important city of the Umayyad Caliphate. The Umayyad Caliphate sent a force down to clear out the pirates, and took the opportunity to annex parts of Eritrea, because why wouldn't you? However, this denied Axum its important access to the coast and its vital trade. Now, I've had to mash up hundreds of years of confused and contradictory events into a historical eaten mess. But Axum's actual end is blamed on Jewish people.
Typical.
Phil, you can't say that.
No, I mean it's typical that Jewish people should be blamed.
Around 960, or so the story goes, Queen Gudit of Beta Israel defeated the empire, burned its churches and literature, and toppled its stele. Now, whether this actually happened or not is debatable, since in Amharic, the native language of Ethiopia, Gudit's name translates as destruction. So while accounts differ, destruction definitely happened, and we can almost certainly say that a bloody woman did it.
Typical.
Right? She's a killer queen. Killer queen or not, Axum civilization was in serious trouble anyway, thanks to good old-fashioned climate change. Whereas in the first century, Axum was set up for greatness thanks to a rainfall bonanza, by the 7th century, Axum was rapidly drying out, not ideal when you have a massive imperial population to support. The result was soil erosion and land degradation. Land that had supported populations for centuries had to be abandoned, with the still fertile highlands providing sanctuary. cut off and shut off from the world, the power of Axum dried up too. What's remarkable about Axum is how long it lasted and how adaptable it proved. For an empire built on trade, Axum should have started declining with the disintegration of the Western Roman Empire, but then it switched to trading with the Eastern Roman Empire. Then it might have come a cropper with competition from the Persians, except it turned itself around and started trading with peoples to its south. It certainly started to decline with the rise of Islam in the 7th century, but not because the armies of the Prophet posed a threat. In fact, certain Axumite kings actually provided sanctuary to early Muslim communities, supposedly including Muhammad's own daughter, so there was no serious attempt from Islamic forces to add Axum to the caliphate. Muhammad was even said to pray for the king of Axum's soul and ordered his followers to leave it in peace. But it was more than just neutrality. See, there was a long-standing Muslim community in Ethiopia called Nagash. One 7th century king of Axum, Ella Saham, welcomed Muslim refugees, and there are stories that Ella Saham secretly converted to Islam. That's a difficult secret to keep. So it's not like a squadron of sword-wielding porkophobes dealt Axum its final blow. But what Islam did was cut Axum off from its traditional markets in Alexandria, Byzantium, and southern Europe. Being dependent on trade, Axum felt the effect of losing access to these vital markets. Cities were abandoned and left undefended, and the Axumites started to migrate to the highlands for better protection. Even the capital of Axum was abandoned and a new capital founded, whose location even the mighty Wikipedia isn't sure about. But, like all great empires, Axum didn't just pop out of existence, and its legacy remains to this day. In one form or another, the Ptolemaic dynasty, claiming a direct line back to King Menelik I, ruled in Ethiopia right up to its dissolution under Emperor Haile Selassie in 1974. That is a long line. The Axumite language of Ge'ez is still spoken by priests during holy services, and, like Latin in the Catholic Church, it's a dialect that no one really understands but allows the congregation to nod off in the back of the church. Go to Ethiopia and you'll still see the hilltop city of Axum, some examples of the towering stelae, and a rich cultural life that is the distinct inheritance of Axum. Ethiopia was never colonized, it was never successfully carved up, and so it lives on as an ancient time capsule of a truly great and a truly African empire. And that really is Axum.
1, 2, 3, 4. Oh!
Let me tell you how it will be. Axum will live on a hill and build steely. Cause this is Axum, yeah, Empire of Axum. Should Ethiopia seem too small, Axum will invade Yemen and take it all, Axum. Cause this is Axum, yeah. Our first king was Menelik, Semitic Kushite dialect.
Thanks for listening, listeners. Next time we'll be joined by a special guest to look further at the amazing Axum Empire. Don't forget to follow us on all the socials at CTDEAPod on the Twitter and Facebook. Email us ctdeapod@gmail.com and visit our website ctdeapod.com where you'll find articles, quizzes and all sorts of extras. So see you next time on...
Countries that don't exist anymore. They used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's countries that don't exist.